So this is our second class in the Torah portions they never told us about. And that includes the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy. That's the material for the whole year. As we said last time, the middle trimester, the second trimester, Gail Stulovitzky will be teaching, and she'll pick up where I left off. And when I come back to Dallas in the end of March, I'll pick up where she left off. That'll probably be someplace near the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy. So last week, we looked at the structure and the order. The structure and the order of the material in the whole book of Numbers. And I just put on the board the four sections of the book we talked about briefly last time. That the first 10 chapters of the book of Numbers take place during the first 2 months of the second year after the Exodus from Egypt. The Israelites are still encamped at Mount Sinai. And what those 10 chapters talk about in those first 2 months of the second year after leaving Egypt are preparations for the journey from the mountain to the land of Israel. And then after we finish those 10 or 11 chapters at the beginning of the book, we hit the second part of the book of Numbers, which is a list of 7 complaints, important events, revolts, basically, of the Israelites against Moshe during the time that they were on the journey. 7 complaints in the desert, and of course one of the major ones is the incident of the spies. And for the revolt at that point, as we all know, the Israelites were condemned to spend 40 years wandering in the desert. The third part of the book is a parsha called Parshat Balak, which is all about the efforts of the prophet and sorcerer Bilam to curse the Jewish people. And then the fourth part of the book has all of the Israelites already after 40 years encamped on the shore of the Jordan River overlooking the city of Jericho, and there are chapters there that are talking about basically the division of the land. After Moses dies, Yeshua will take over, they'll go into the land, and it'll be divided according to the laws that are discussed there in the last few chapters of the book of Numbers. So that's a basic overview. And last time we focused on the first part, the first fourth. We talked about its structure and how it fits in with events that are described in the book of Exodus and in the book of Leviticus. And now we can begin today's class with that short review. So we're going to talk today, as the sheet says, about the Levites and the firstborn. And the Levites and the firstborn is one of the major themes that appears and reappears and appears again in these first 10 chapters of the book, which make up the first section of the book of Numbers. So let's just jump right into it. And as usual, almost everything that I can think that I might say is written on the sheet. So it's our guidepost. We're going to look first at chapter 1, verses 1 to 20. Some of this material we read briefly last time for our structural introduction, and now we're seeing it again for its actual content. Okay, so that's the book of Numbers, Sefer Bamidbar, chapter 1, verses 1 to 20. On the first day of the first month, in the second year, following the exodus from the land of Egypt, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, they're still at the mountain, in the tent of meeting, right, that's the tabernacle, saying, take a census of the whole Israel community by the clans of its ancestral houses, listing the names every male head by head. You and Aaron shall record them by their groups from the age of 20 years up, all those in Israel who are able to bear arms. This is a preparation for the journey in the desert, which will end up with the army attacking the nations of Canaan, nations of the land of Israel. Associated with you shall be a man from each tribe, associated with you with Moshe, each one the head of his ancestral tribe. In other words, someone who's going to help you to count the people, do the census. And now you might think that we might as well skip verses 5 to 15 with the names, but actually we're going to read it, because there's something important there. And what's important there is what it doesn't say. So look for what it doesn't say in verses 5 to 15. From Reuven, Elitzur ben Shedeor. From Shimon, Shalumiel ben Tzuri Shaddai. From Yehuda, Nachshon ben Aminadav. From Yisachar, Netanel ben Suar. From Zvulun, Eliab ben Chilon. From the sons of Yosef, from Ephraim, Elishama ben Amihud. From Menashe, Gamliel ben Petatzur. From Binyamin, Abidan ben Gidoni. From Dan, Achiezer ben Amishaddai. From Asher, Pagiel ben Ochran. From Gad, Eliasaf Eliasaph ben Duel. From Naphtali, Ahira ben Enan. Who's missing?
Reuven.
Levi. Very good, right? There are, if you count, 12 tribes, but the way we got the 12 tribes is that the tribe of Yosef is divided into two, Ephraim and Menasheh. The truth is, when you count everyone, there's really 13 tribes. Even when we talk about 12, there's 13 tribes counting everyone, and the tribe of Levi is missing. I'll just read a little bit more. These are the elected of the assembly, the chieftains of their ancestral tribes, their heads of the contingents of Israel. So Moses and Aaron took those men who were designated by name. On the first day of the second month, they convoked the whole community who were registered by the clans of their ancestral houses, the names of those 20 years and over being listed head by head. As the Lord had commanded Moses, so he recorded them in the wilderness, and the total as follows. And then the whole chapter gives you the census results. It's pretty boring. And the point that I wanted to make, as Michael just said, is that for some reason Levi is missing. And then we get to verse 21. 21? Yeah, 21. So for verse 21, it gives you the, as I said, the results of the sentence. Census. Thank you. And it goes through all the tribes, and of course it doesn't mention Levi, because Levi wasn't mentioned when we were told to do this census, until we get to verse, 44. Those are the enrollments recorded by Moses and Aaron and by the chieftains of Israel, who were 12 in number, each one man to each ancestral house. All the Israelites, aged 20 years and over, and enrolled by ancestral houses, all those in Israel able to bear arms, all those who were enrolled came to 603,550. The Levites, however, were not recorded among them by their ancestral tribe. For the Lord had spoken to Moshe, saying, do not on any account enroll the tribe of Levi or take a census of them with the Israelites. You shall put the Levites in charge of the tabernacle, the pact, etc. Now I just want to point out, for the sake of intellectual honesty, that I just read from the JPS translation. So that's what Carol Ann has, and that's what Gabby has. It's not a literal translation. And the translation that I just read is actually an effort to paper over a bit of a problem here in the text. What the Hebrew really says is the following. 47, the Levites, however, were not recorded among them by their ancestral tribe. And then in the Hebrew, there's a paragraph break. Right, in the Sefer Torah, the Torah that we have written according to tradition, there are paragraphs. And verse 47 ends a paragraph. I don't know if you can, you can't see it in the JPS, perhaps in the art school you can see it. You have it there. Mm-hmm. Yes, so in that sense the art school is more authentic. And then verse 48 seems to begin a new thought. And it's not, it doesn't say in Hebrew, for the Lord had spoken. For the Lord had spoken, that, how do you call it, a conjunction, for? They put that in to make it make sense. But what it really, and secondly, it says in 48, for the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, they translated in the pluperfect, for the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, and the way this translation has it is that, okay, the Levites were not recorded, and the reason is because God had said to Moses, do not enroll them. But that's not what we have in Hebrew. In the Hebrew, it ends verse 47, saying the Levites were not recorded. And why they were not recorded? Because we just saw that when God said, take the census, God said, of these 12 tribes, and he didn't list the Levites. It's not that God says specifically, don't enroll the Levites, just that he mentioned all the tribes except the Levites. And 47 just sums that up, and 48 begins a new thought. And the new thought is that the Lord spoke. It doesn't say, had spoken. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, do not, on any account, enroll the tribe of Levi or take a census. In other words, only after the census was taken, it didn't include Levi, because God didn't include Levi in the list, did God say to Moses, and indeed, we're not going to take Levi now, it's not going to be part of the census. And the reason is, verse 50, you shall put the Levites in charge of the tabernacle of the pact. Where the Levites are different. All the tribes have the task of being counted for war and for the journey, whereas the Levites are not being counted because they have a different task. In other words, verse 48 is not a continuation of 47, it's rather an introduction to 50. Don't take a census.
Were they considered a superior tribe?
So we have to talk about why they're different, right? That's right, the obvious question. And in a certain sense, they're superior. In a certain sense, they're inferior, as we're about to see. But that's exactly where we're leading. They're given a separate job. They're not soldiers. They're not soldiers bearing arms. Rather, and I'll read now verse 50 going on, you shall put the Levites in charge of the tabernacle of the pact. Right? That is the tabernacle, all its furnishings and everything that pertains to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall tend it. And they shall camp around the tabernacle. When the tabernacle is to set out, the Levites shall take it down. When the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levites shall set it up. Any outsider who encroaches shall be put to death. The Israelites shall encamp troop by troop, each man with his division and each under his standard. The Levites, however, shall camp around the tabernacle of the pact, that wrath may not strike the Israelite community. The Levites shall stand guard around the tabernacle of the pact. So this brings up a theme we talked about last year, and I'll just briefly mention that the tabernacle, as a symbolic and perhaps even more than a symbolic home of God, is a place of tremendous holiness and a place of tremendous energy, and therefore a place of tremendous danger to human beings. That you can't get too close, or else you'll be. Remember my famous word?
What?
Right? He knows English better than you do. You'll be zapped.
Oh, okay.
Right?
For something more intellectual.
Well, so God is symbolized by fire, right? By lightning, by thunder, as we remember at Mount Sinai. And the tabernacle is a portable Mount Sinai that wants to contain that energy so that it could speak to Moses with the rest of the laws of the Torah. And only the Kohanim, only the Kohen, that is to say Aaron and his sons, are allowed in the tabernacle, and Moses. And anyone else who comes in will be zapped. It's not a place for foreigners. Foreigners, I mean those who aren't on that level of sanctity. And the job of the Levites, and this again is a review of things we talked about last year, is to act as a buffer to prevent that energy from straying out and prevent the Israelites from straying in. They're guards, and not only do they guard the tabernacle when it's stationary, when it's functioning, but they guard it as it's being taken down and as it's being put up. They have to make sure that only they have contact with the different piece of furniture when it's being disassembled. Only they have contact when they're carrying it through the desert, and only they have contact with it when it's being put together again, when they come to their campsite by the Levites.
Were the Kohanim from all the other different tribes, or they were a tribe in and of themselves?
The Kohanim are one family from the tribe of Levi.
Okay.
And it's only Aaron and his sons. That's all it is.
Right? Okay.
In the book of the Torah,
okay,
it's only five people, right? It's mm-hmm. Aaron and Nadav and Avihu, who died, and Eleazar and Itamar. It's only altogether five people.
So it's a very, very, even today, it's a very small percentage of the population that are Kohanim.
Right, right. Then it was less than 0.0%. Today, it's much more for some reason. I don't know why, but today, Kohanim are more than 1% of the Jewish population. Right? We all know people who are Kohanim.
Had a lot of children.
Because I think it's more last name than it used to be.
Yeah. I didn't understand what you're saying.
I mean, percentages back then you have that same last name like today.
Yeah, but then it was five people out of 600,000.
Yeah.
That's less than 0.01%.
So what you're saying is that their descendants
multiplied
are just multiplied at a greater rate than the rest of the population.
It looks like, again, I'm not here, a demographer. I have no idea. But it could be that the Kohanim maintained greater fidelity to Jewish identity than other Jews do. And if that is true, it makes sense. Right? But that's just my theory.
You said there was a positive reason and a negative reason that the Levites would be in that role.
Yeah.
What was the negative?
I didn't say it yet.
Okay.
I left that.
Okay.
I digress, but this never occurred to me before. I guess Moses didn't have any sons who were considered Israelites?
Moses didn't have, his sons had no special function.
Okay.
No special function.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I'll just add, going back to the demographic thing, by definition, of course, converts can't be Kohanim. Right? You know the joke about the... So I'll tell you the joke. There's this guy who walks into the rabbi's study and he says, Rabbi, I want to be a Kohen. They get such honors in the synagogue. And the rabbi says, you can't be a Kohen. Can't. You're not. So the guy says, Rabbi, I'll give $1,000 donation to the synagogue. The rabbi says, but I can't. You're not a Kohen. What can I do? The guy says, I'll give $10,000. The rabbi is really flustered, but he says, there's no way I can do it. The guy says, $100,000 I'll give the synagogue if you only make me a Kohen. The rabbi says, I can't just make you a Kohen, but tell me, why do you want to be a Kohen? So the guy says, my father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen, I want to be a Kohen. So anyway...
taking that $100,000.
I once read something, and I don't know if it's true or not, where they can actually tell by your DNA, you can like swab your cheek and
yes.
send it in somewhere,
yeah.
and they can tell what tribe you're descended from and confirm whether or not you're...
Yeah, I've read also, I don't know again details, but I've read about the studies. It's not 100% foolproof, not at all, but they... It more works in the other direction. In other words, taking swabs of DNA from Kohenim, they found that 90% of them have similar genetic markers.
Mm-hmm.
So they really do go back
mm-hmm.
to a certain man 3,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, actually.
Wow.
It's just fascinating to see to what degree the Jewish people, and especially the family of Kohenim, have maintained fidelity to the tradition.
They don't all have the name Cohen. Could have different names and still be...
Yeah,
it's spelled a lot of different ways.
Yeah, there's no need to have the name. I mean, it was only 200 years ago that people started getting last names. Right before
mm-hmm.
that, you were someone, the son of your father.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you have the name Cohen, like Todd Cohen said, spelled many different ways,
mm-hmm.
sometimes with a K, sometimes with a C, sometimes like the Cohen brothers of the filmmaking industry, C-O-E-N, without an H there, some have an H. Also, the name Kagan is a Cohen name.
Mm-hmm.
The name Katz...
W-E-N the other day.
I've never heard of that one.
But not everybody with that name is necessarily...
90%, 95% are. We had a Rabbi Cohen in Dallas until 4 years ago who wasn't a Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'll just tell you, by the way, Katz and Kagan are also Kohenim, and also named Rappaport.
Mm-hmm.
Jews who are named Rappaport are usually Kohenim.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're a Kohen.
Yes.
We have a real one right here on display.
It's based on the paternal bloodline, not the maternal.
It's based on how much money his father gave.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
No, it's based, you're right. It's based on the paternal bloodline.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I did read in the Conservative, in that Eitz Chaim, that that a woman could also, if the father was a Kohen, that the woman, as her, the daughter could...
Yeah, my wife is a Bat Kohen. She's
mm-hmm.
the daughter of a Kohen.
Mm-hmm.
And that has one halachic ramification, which we'll talk about in another hour.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is one that's very relevant to me
mm-hmm.
and to my sons. And there's also a relevance to being the daughter of a Levite, which is more our subject, right? Our subject
mm-hmm.
now is not the Kohenim, it's the Levites. And there's also a halachic ramification to being the daughter of a Levite.
I'm the daughter of a Levite.
You are?
Yeah.
Ah! So we'll talk about you in another
okay.
in another hour.
Okay.
Okay. I'll be prepared to be talked about. Okay. So now, I don't remember exactly where we were. Let's see. How did we get to this? How did we get off? No, I'm not blaming you. I'm just trying to remember
where we were. Saying that the Levites are the ones who carry the tabernacle.
Right.
And
right.
That's where we were.
Right. So we read here at the end of chapter one. That they carry the tabernacle and that they are the buffer against divine wrath, as it were. Okay, so we understand their job. They dismantle the tabernacle, they carry it, they erect it, and they guard it. And with that, we're going to go on to chapter 3. Chapter 2 is about the census that was taken of the non-Levites. right? Not only how many are each tribe, but actually where they were to encamp when they're marching and how their formations were as they're going through the desert. That's chapter 2. Chapter 3 brings us back to the Levites. So let's look at verses 6 to 9 in chapter 3. Ready? Mm-hmm. Chapter 3, verses 6 to 9. Advance the tribe of Levi. I should have read the beginning. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, advance the tribe of Levi and place them in attendance upon Aaron, the priest, the servant. Priest is Kohen. So the Levites are to be in attendance upon Aaron, the Kohen. Their assistants, as it were, to their priests, to the Kohanim. They shall perform duties for him and for the whole community before the tent of meeting, doing the work of the tabernacle. They shall take charge of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting and duty on behalf of the Israelites during the work of the tabernacle. So it both says that they're working for Aaron and for the Israelites, and we're using the phrase in two different senses. They're working for Aaron in the sense that they're assisting Aaron, he's the boss. On the other hand, they're working for the Israelites in that they're representing the Israelites. And also in the sense that they're making sure that the Israelites don't encroach upon the tabernacle and get fried. That's a new word. It means zapped, if you have to look it up in the thesaurus. Fried and zapped are the same thing. Okay. Read one more verse. You shall assign the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are formally assigned to him from among the Israelites. And we're not going to read all the verses, but the verse says that some Levites have this job, they carry this piece of furnishing, and others have a different job, they carry this piece of furnishing. Each one has its own job in the tabernacle. Let's read on to verse 10, 11, 12, and 13. You shall make Aaron and his sons responsible for observing their priestly duties. Again, that's the priest, that's the Kohen. And any outsider who encroaches shall be put to death. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I hereby take the Levites from among the Israelites in place of all the firstborn. A new idea. The first issue of the womb among the Israelites, the Levites shall be mine. For every firstborn is mine. At the time that I smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated every firstborn in Israel, man and beast to myself, to be mine, the Lord's. I'm going to spend a long time talking about those verses. So in general, it says that there's something about the firstborn that are consecrated to God because of the events that happened in the 10th plague in Egypt. And that holiness of the firstborn is going to be transferred to the Levites. And the firstborn are going to lose that holiness. So we're going to spend now a lot of time talking about the concept of firstborn. The concept of firstborn, then about the Levites and the one taking the place of the other. So I went through the whole book of Genesis, the book of Bereshit, and I listed here at the bottom all of the mentions of this idea of firstborn. We're going to go through all of them. And there's something pretty fascinating that we can discover here, I think. So here they are. Let's just go through them. Chapter 22, verse 20. Excuse me. So in the book of Bereshit, Genesis 22, verse 20. 22, verse 20. And this is a verse that doesn't have anything to do with anything, so it seems. And all it says is the following. Sometime later, Avraham was told, Milcah too has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz, the firstborn, and Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Aram, and etc., 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 etc. And the only reason we're looking at the verse is to point out that one child is called the firstborn. In other words, there's something to being firstborn. You have a status as a firstborn. It's not like the secondborn is called the secondborn, and the thirdborn is called the thirdborn, right? Only the firstborn is called the one who's born first. So there's something to it, and this is before the Torah, before the Jewish people. Another example, Genesis chapter 25, verses 24 to 26. This is talking about the sons of Rebekah and Isaac. When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red, right? It's 25, 25. The first one emerged red like a hairy mantle all over, so they named him Esau. Then his brother emerged holding onto the heel of Esau, so they named him Yaakov. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. And the Torah, of course, points out which was born first, which was born second, and then move to verse 31, the whole story of the selling of the birthright for a pot of porridge. Jacob said in verse 31, after his brother asked to have something to eat, "First sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "I am at the point of death, so what use is my birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. Jacob then gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank and rose and went away. Thus did Esau spurn his birthright. So apparently, the right of the first one is something important. The fact that Esau was willing to sell it, the Torah looks at it as a very despicable thing to do. He spurned his birthright. And how did he get it? Only from being born first. That's all. There's something about being born first. And again, this is nothing about laws of the Torah. It's just an anthropological snapshot of the way people thought and understood their own lives. Let's look at the same two boys, chapter 27, verses 18 and 19. Chapter 27, verses 18 to 19. This is the same two boys, Esau and Yaakov, born to Rivka and Isaac. And as you know the story, one impersonates his brother to get the blessing of the firstborn. And let's read two verses. In verse 18, it's talking about Yaakov, Jacob. He went to his father and said, "Father." And he said, "Yes, which of my sons are you?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn." He doesn't just identify himself by name. There's something to being the firstborn. And indeed, the whole story is about getting the blessing of the firstborn. So again, it's just to point out that there's something here, irregardless of laws of the Torah. Let's look at chapter 35, verse 22b. 35. The middle of verse 22. This is about the 12 sons of Jacob. Chapter 35, verse 22 in the middle. "Now the sons of Jacob were 12 in number. The sons of Leah, Reuven, Jacob's firstborn, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, etc." Just pointing out that Reuven is called the firstborn. There's something to it. Let's go on to chapter 36, verse 15. Chapter 36, verse 15. These are the clans of the children of Esau, descendants of Esau's firstborn, Eliphaz, etc. Again, pointing out that Esau's firstborn son is called the firstborn. Let's go to chapter 38, verse 6. This is the story of Judah and Tamar. Judah got a wife for heir his firstborn. That's it. He's identified as the firstborn. Then,
so, is there any explanation anywhere that talks about why the firstborn is so important?
Well, we can extrapolate. Everyone knows, at least it used to be like this, that you walk into a barbershop or you walk into a shoe repair shop, and on the wall you see framed a dollar bill. And what is it? It's the first dollar bill that we made when we opened the store. Right? I don't see that today so much, but. The first has a significance, mm-hmm. Right? There are people who have a vegetable garden, especially when they first have a vegetable garden, for their first tomato or their first ear of corn, right? It represents something. It represents a beginning, a breakthrough. It's something that represents the work you put into it. So the firstborn just seems to represent, talking from the point of view of the father, represents you, right? That's, I grew up, I went through my childhood, I got married, here's the fruit, here's the symbol of my success, right? That's what it seems to be. And in many ancient cultures, we know that the firstborn had a significance. He was considered to be him who had the responsibility to carry on his father's line, his father's legacy.
But it's more so for a firstborn son than a firstborn daughter.
Absolutely. Look, we're talking about a patriarchal society,
mm-hmm.
Right? But I'll point out that the son who's born after a daughter doesn't have the status of a firstborn. The daughter doesn't, but neither does the son. There was no firstborn.
Okay. So there was no firstborn. A firstborn son.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a particularly Jewish thing, but it just seems to be a standard cultural.
But wouldn't that second child, the son, the firstborn son, be the one that would inherit the most of the property and things in this culture? I mean,
when the halacha talks in the book of Deuteronomy about inheritance, the firstborn son gets a double portion, but only if he's the firstborn son, not if he came after a girl.
Not if he came
after. There's no firstborn. There's no firstborn.
Mm-hmm. Poor thing. He didn't have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. He still has to suffer.
Right?
So does that mean that all the siblings then get equal portions?
Yeah. Yeah. There's just no firstborn son. The expression in Hebrew for the firstborn is Peter Rechem, he who opens the womb. If something else opens the womb, which could be a girl or could be a miscarriage, for example, then there's no firstborn.
Oh, even a miscarriage counts.
So a miscarriage negates it. Wow.
Yeah. Here I'm getting more into halachic categories. But as far as the ancient world, certainly a girl is born first, and that family is just no firstborn. And I can certainly understand it. Again, in a patriarchal society, the father and even the mother are looking forward to the firstborn being a child, a male. And if it's not, there's a disappointment. There's no firstborn in this family. Again, I'm not telling you my views. I'm just, trying to present to you what I know to be the standard cultural assumptions of so many ancient cultures, including, apparently, what we have in the Torah. Right? Let's go on a little bit. Chapter 38, we want to look at verses 27 to 30. Still, it's the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And now Tamar is giving birth. 38 to 27. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one of them put out his hand, and the midwife tied a crimson thread on that hand to signify this one came out first. It's important to know, apparently, which of the twins is going to be first, even if it's just a 5-second difference. But just then he drew back his hand and out came his brother. And she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." So he was named Peretz, which means to thrust yourself out. So again, just showing you that it's important to the midwife who comes first. Let's see another set of verses. Chapter 48, verse 12. Moving to the end of the book of Genesis. 48:12. These are the Joseph stories. 48 verses 12 to 13. We're talking about Joseph and his sons. Chapter 48, verse 12. And henceforth, Joseph then removed them from his knees. The two little boys were on the knees of Joseph's father, the boy's grandfather, meaning Jacob, Yaakov, and bowed low with his face to the ground. Joseph took the two of them, Ephraim with his right hand to Israel's left. Israel is another word for Jacob, the grandfather, and Manasseh with his left hand to Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, thus crossing his hands, right? The two kids are on his knees, and he blesses them like this. So with his right hand, which symbolizes the stronger hand, the better, on the hand of the one who's not the firstborn. And he blessed Jacob, saying...
But weren't Joseph's children not Jewish because the mother was a Jew?
According to our halakha, wouldn't be Jewish. Yep. Just before the halakha, right?
Oh, okay.
Right? But okay. Good point. So he blessed Joseph, saying... In other words... Israel, Jacob, the grandfather, blessed his son Joseph by blessing his grandchildren. We know the blessing. I won't read that. Verse 17, when Joseph saw that his father was placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he thought it wrong. So he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh. Not so, Father Joseph said to his father, for the other is the firstborn, place your right hand on his head. But his father objected, saying, I know, my son, I know, he too shall be a people, and he too shall be great, yet his younger brother shall be greater than him, and his offspring shall be plentiful enough for nations, etc. So there's a lot going on here, and we're not going to look at it all, but I just want to make two related points, which is that both the grandfather and the father, Jacob, Israel, and the son, Joseph, they both know that there's something extremely significant concerning the firstborn. The second point is that this story is subversive vis-a-vis the tradition and the idea that the firstborn is the more important son. Here we see that Jacob, Israel, knows that the firstborn is usually the most important one, but in this case, not. That's an interesting way to end the book of Genesis, where we've seen again and again and again this very clear cultural assumption that the firstborn has a unique status, and the book ends by pointing out it's not necessarily so. Not that this story doesn't know about that, it knows about it, and particularly and purposely subverts that tradition. And it just so happens that there's another story at the end of Genesis that also serves to subvert the tradition of the firstborn. And that brings us to chapter 48. That's where we were. It brings us to chapter 49, verses 1 to 4. Chapter 49, verses 1 to 4 is when now Jacob is on his deathbed, and he's blessing not his grandchildren, but his children, right? The 12 tribes of Israel. Chapter 49, and Jacob called his sons and said, come together that I may tell you what is to befall you in the days to come. Assemble and hearken, O sons of Jacob, hearken to Israel your father. Reuven, you are my firstborn, my might and first fruit of my vigor. That relates to what you brought up. He's the representative of his father's vigor, exceeding in rank and exceeding in honor. Unstable as water, you shall excel no longer. For when you mounted your father's bed, you brought disgrace, my couch he mounted. What it's referring to is not clear. There's different opinions. But in any case, here, the father Jacob is recognizing Reuven is the firstborn and is dethroning him. In some sense, in some way, saying, you no longer deserve the honor of the firstborn. So it's just fascinating, and it actually is foreshadowing of what's going to come later, that the book of Genesis recognizes the institution of the firstborn, and twice at the end of the book purposely subverts it. And that's going to be the background of what we're reading about today in this class in the book of Numbers, that we see that the Levites, remember, take the place of the firstborn as God's chosen. Okay. So, what else did I want to add? Yeah. So now let's read even more. You're still here, right?
No.
Did you say no?
No, I said I'm here. We're here.
Okay. The book of Exodus. The book of Exodus. We're looking at, it's at the top of the sheet that I prepared, the second side of the sheet, in the second bullet point, chapter 11, verses 1, and then 4 to 8. In Exodus chapter 11, verses 1, and then 4 to 8, we're at the end of the 10 plagues. It says in chapter 11, verse 1, and the Lord said to Moshe, I will bring but one more plague upon Paro and upon Egypt, etc. And then verse 4, so we know this, the last plague coming. Verse 4 of chapter 11, Moses said, thus says the Lord, toward midnight I will go forth among the Egyptians, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. Then the firstborn of Paro sits on his throne, to the firstborn of the slave girls behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle. There shall be a loud cry, etc., etc., etc. So why did God choose to kill the firstborn? Well, of course, you could have chosen to kill all the Egyptians, but if he's going to choose just one each family, well, the firstborn is the logical choice, because that represents the vigor and the honor of the family. So that's what happens. And then we go on to chapter 12, verse 21, and it says the following. In chapter 12, verse 21, And this is before the event happened, before the firstborn were killed. We just read now that's going to happen, and now we're still reading what's happening before the event actually takes place. Chapter 12, verse 21. Laura, you're looking around there.
No, I'm not finding where the book of Exodus is in here.
Now you're closer to it.
Okay. Oh, here it is.
So we're in chapter 12, verse 21. Moses then summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go pick out lambs for your families and slaughter the Passover offering." He's preparing them for the Passover meal. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in blood that's in the altar, in the basin, etc., etc., etc. Verse 23, "For when the Lord goes through to smite the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, and the Lord will pass over the door, not let the destroyer enter and smite your home." Right, so that's when the firstborn will be killed, the Israelite firstborn will be saved because of the blood on the doorpost. Then it says in verse 24, "You shall observe this as an institution for all time, for you and for your descendants." There's the Passover meal every year. "And when you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised, you shall observe this rite, this mitzvah. And when your children ask you what you mean by this rite, by this service, you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, because he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but saved our houses." And it's referring to saving the firstborn. The firstborn represents, again, the honor of the house. And they're going to be saved when the Egyptian firstborn are going to be killed. And it says in verse 29, "In the middle of the night, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Paro who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captives in the dungeon, all the firstborn of the cattle," etc., etc., etc. So, look at the way I put this on the sheet here. In where are we going to look? Look at 4. The salvation from the plague did not create their status. It was rather a result in a confirmation of that status. And it's not that the firstborn get a special status of being consecrated to God because they were saved here. They had that status beforehand. It's just that the whole matter of the killing of the Egyptian firstborn and the saving of the Israelite firstborn, that happened because the firstborn is already a well-known institution. So this doesn't create that status. It rather is a result of that status, and it confirms that status, that now the firstborn Israelites are really consecrated to a special status in the eyes of God. And now we're going to read chapter 13 of Exodus, verse 1 and then 11.
I have a question.
Of course.
The first one you said is because it's like the first one that born from. That if the father had different wives, the firstborn of each wife would be considered a firstborn.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. And in halakha, there's a big discussion of that. And I don't know, but I can tell you the following. Let's just think of Jacob, who had 4 wives and 12 children. Only Reuven is called the firstborn, although it would seem he should have 4 firstborn. Mm-hmm. Well, we see from the fact that only Reuven is called the firstborn, it could be that the real status of firstborn is upon the child who is both the firstborn of the mother and of the father. That's what it looks like. If Reuven is the only one that's called the firstborn, as he is, then he was the firstborn of the wife that had the first child to this husband Jacob. That seems to be the case.
Was it a practice in that time that if a man married a woman and she did not give him a firstborn, that he would or could leave her and go remarry?
I never heard of such a thing. And the reason not is because if he remarried, the child born there wouldn't be a firstborn, because he already had his firstborn and it wasn't the firstborn.
But I thought I remember reading something that if you have 7 children and you don't...
That's separate from this whole story.
Yeah.
What you have is the following. You have, I'll divide it into 2, that there's a mitzvah to procreate, And if a man and woman are married, and after 10 years they don't have children, the halakha allows or commands, not clear, divorce. So that the assumption, again, being it's the woman's fault, again, excuse me. And by the way, I read some studies in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago. It's another subject. How they're showing that, I'll just say parenthetically, how they've discovered things that we haven't known, that men's poriut, how do you say poriut in English? Men's ability to procreate is drastically reduced with age, no different than in the case of a woman. Anyway, so back to the subject. So, divorce is at least an available course if after 10 years a man and a woman have not had children. That's what I know. Now, there's something else, that there's a mitzvah to have a boy and a girl. If you don't have a boy and a girl, you have to keep trying until you have at least one and one. But I never heard this thing about divorce. If there's seven, you said...
I don't know where I heard that. I never heard.
Okay. If it were true, there would be a ground for divorce whether it was seven girls or seven boys, because the mitzvah is to have one of each. Yeah. My son has three sons, so they're still trying. That's a girl. Okay, so we were right over here. Right. So now, all right, we were looking at chapter 13, verse 1, which says, "The Lord spoke further to Moshe, saying, consecrate to me every firstborn," this is after the Exodus now, "man and beast, the first issue of every womb among the Israelites mine." God owns the firstborn. And again, a double reason, because it's the firstborn, and because of the plague of the firstborn. But it's not just the plague of the firstborn. That status of the firstborn precedes the plague. And then it says in verse 11 and henceforth the following: "And when the Lord has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, into the land of Israel, as he swore to you and to your fathers and has given it to you, you shall set apart for the Lord every first issue of the womb. Every male firstling that your cattle drop shall be the Lord's." Right, that's a given. That's the firstborn. That's the first dollar bill. "But every firstling ass you shall redeem with the sheep. If you do not redeem it, you must break its neck. You redeem every firstborn male among your children." But the firstborn male of the children of human beings belongs to God, but you can't leave it with God. You have to redeem it and take it for yourself. But you owe something to God in place. And when in time to come your sons ask you, what does this mean? That's when you do a ceremony of redeeming the firstborn, and your sons ask you, why are you doing this? You shall say, it was with a mighty hand that the Lord brought us out of Egypt, the house of bondage. When Paro stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord slew every firstborn in the land of Egypt, the firstborn of both man and beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord every first male issue of the womb of animals, but redeem every firstborn among my sons." Now, what does it mean to redeem a firstborn son? We have to wait to the book of Numbers to figure out what that means. I'm going to move right now, as the bullet point says, to Numbers chapter 18. You see where I am on the sheet, so you don't lose your place here. We're going to move to Numbers chapter 18 to see the halachic details of what it means to redeem a firstborn male child. So we're in the book of Numbers, Sefer Bamidbar, of course, the book we started in, and we're in chapter 18, verse 8, and then verse 18. Verse 8 of chapter 18 says, "The Lord spoke further to Aharon," that is to say, to the Kohen.
Numbers 18.
Numbers 18, verse 8, "The Lord spoke further to Aharon." I'm going to wait for Lori to find the place. Do you have the book of Numbers?
Yeah, I'm not here.
I'm here. Chapter
18.
Chapter
18. Okay. Coming there. Okay.
Chapter 18, and verse 8 said, "The Lord spoke further to Aharon." So God's talking to Aharon. Now I'm going to move to verse 13. So in a continuation of God talking to Aharon, the priest, it says in verse 13, "The first fruits of everything in their land that they bring to the Lord shall be yours. And what does it mean to give the first fruits to God? It means to bring it to the temple, to the high priest in the temple. To your, it will be yours, says God to Aaron. Every one of your household who is clean may eat of them. Anyone who is ritually pure may eat of the first fruits that the Israelites bring to the tabernacle, to the temple. Everything that has been proscribed in Israel shall be yours. That's a different subject. And now we get to verse 15. The first issue of the womb of every being, man or beast, that is offered to the Lord shall be yours. So Aaron the priest, as a representative of God and the temple, owns every firstborn of man or beast. But you shall have the firstborn of man redeemed, and you shall also have the firstling of unclean animals redeemed. Take as their redemption price from the age of 1 month up, the money equivalent of 5 shekels by the sanctuary weight, which is 20 gerah. But the firstlings of cattle, sheep, or goats may not be redeemed. They are consecrated. Okay? So that means that someone comes to the temple and he says, here's my firstborn goat, my firstborn sheep. It belongs to Aaron. Belongs to the sanctuary. But when the person comes and says to Aaron, here's my firstborn son, Aaron has to say, give me 5 shekel for it and I'll give it to you back. It's a commandment not to leave the son consecrated to God, to the tabernacle, but to get him back in the redemption ceremony.
That's a tax.
It's a tax. It's a, yeah, it's a tithe. It's a tax, right. Right. Right.
So tithe is different than a tax.
Well,
more of a tithe.
Tithe is the religious word, right? But tithe really usually means a tenth. So in that sense, it's really not a tithe. And we're going to talk later at the very end about how this ceremony of redemption of the firstborn is still done today. Although I must admit, I've never been to a redemption of a firstborn in Dallas.
You know, when my firstborn was born, we had a pinion up in Minnesota. That's where I lived at the time. And then when my son had a son, and I said to the rabbi, don't we have to have this pinion up then, you know? And he said, no.
I'll tell you.
I mean, that's just obviously his...
Yeah. I would say exactly the opposite. Because actually.
I'm very bad about that we didn't do that.
You can still do it. I'm serious.
Okay.
I have a lot of stories about this. But just let me say that you said that you're the daughter of a Levite.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter of a Levite, when her firstborn is born, doesn't have to redeem him.
Oh, well, we did.
Because that's what I was, I mean, earlier I said, the daughter of a Levite has a certain halakhic status. So now I'm going to tell that story.
I don't think I did it for my son either, and I think it had something to do with the what tribe is.
Are you the daughter
was.
Of a Levite?
I don't think so.
Are you the daughter of a Kohen?
No. Mm-mm. No, but I'm not sure what my ex-husband was. But I remember asking the rabbi if we needed to.
So if your ex-husband was a Kohen or a Levite...
I think he's a Levite.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the answer.
Okay, because I remember them saying that we weren't supposed to do it, and I didn't remember why.
So now listen to this story that directly relates to what Carol Ann just said. When I am a firstborn. When I, at the age of about 21, heard of the mitzvah of the redemption of the firstborn, so I was in Israel. It could be Carol Ann heard this story already. Perhaps I'll listen to her. I wrote a letter to my parents. In those days, there were phones, but we didn't use them, from Israel to America. I wrote a letter to my parents asking if I had been redeemed. And my mother wrote back, no. So I wrote another letter asking why. And the answer that I got was, because we are a family of Kohanim. I said, you never told me that before. That's pretty significant. So I wrote back again, and I wrote, are you sure? The answer was, we made a mistake. No, we meant we're Levites. And the halakha is that the son of Levites, just like the son of Kohanim, doesn't have to be redeemed. So then I wrote back again, are you sure? And they said, no, we were wrong again. We're not Kohanim, we're not Levites. Rather, now get this genealogy, rather they said to me that my father's mother was the daughter of a Levite. My father's mother was the daughter of a Levite, like Carolina's daughter of a Levite. And the rabbi told us that therefore we don't have to do a pidyon. So that's why they didn't redeem me. But they got it a little bit wrong. My father, who is the son of the daughter of a Levite, really doesn't have to be redeemed. That's true. And that would be your firstborn son. Wouldn't have to be redeemed. But the next generation, so my father didn't have to be redeemed. He was the firstborn, but he was the son of the daughter of a Levite. Doesn't have to be redeemed. But his firstborn son, my father's not a Levite, because his mother was the daughter of a Levite, but it wasn't that his father was. Only his mother. It doesn't go through the mother, it goes through the father. My father didn't have to be redeemed, but I did have to be redeemed. But my parents got it wrong. So I had to redeem myself at the age of 22. Just like the Torah says.
And you can do it yourself, or your parents
do it yourself.
Have to do it.
Right. So I studied these laws quite extensively then. So the Torah says at what age to redeem a firstborn son. We just read it. What age? We just read it, right? We just said it right here? 1 month up. The age of 1 month.
Yeah.
And but my parents didn't redeem me at the age of 1 month. So I had to redeem myself. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, talks about the fact that firstborn sons who lose their father before the age of 30 days and are put in an orphanage, the community has to pay money to make a strong necklace to put around the baby's neck that says firstborn unredeemed. And this is true. And the child lives with that as an orphan until the age of 13. When he's 13, he sees that he has this necklace around his neck and it says unredeemed. And then the community tells him, at the age of 13, it's now your responsibility to redeem yourself. This is really true. Anyway, I didn't have that necklace, right? I wasn't an orphan. My parents thought they didn't have to redeem me. But at the age of 22, I did a redemption ceremony for myself, which means that I take 5 shekels and I give it to the Kohen. And the Kohen releases me from my status as being a firstborn consecrated to God. Now, the funny part of the story, and sad also, is that this took place when I was about 22. And the young man who was the Kohen was a friend of mine, who I knew from yeshiva. And he was a immigrant to Israel from England. Now, when I ran into him on the street a few years after the Pidyon HaBen, the ceremony of redemption, he said, "I have a story to tell you." He had just come back from England, where he talked to his father's brother, his uncle, on the man's deathbed. Now, my friend's name was Michael Kagan, and Kagan is known to be a name of Kohanim. He told me that my uncle told me that our name is really not Kagan.
Oh, no.
The immigration officials in Liverpool, when we got out of Europe, gave us that name. We're not Kagan, we're not Kohanim. What does that mean for me? I'm unredeemed.
You're not redeemed.
What do I have to do?
Do it again.
Find another Kohen.
God will take your shekel.
Find another Kohen.
So
I found another Kohen.
A person like my grandson that was never redeemed, we could redeem him now by paying 5 shekels to a Kohanim?
Yeah, it worked, Todd. So let me just get it straight.
I've got three grandsons that need to be redeemed.
So you're talking about children who are the firstborn of their father and mother.
Yes.
And neither of the parents are Kohanim or Levites, and the woman is not a daughter of a Levite. Your daughter, right, is not the daughter of a Levite, because Jay is not a Levite.
Not a Levite.
Right. So if they're really firstborn, right, there was no miscarriage or female before them, and if neither parents are Kohen or Levite, then you do Pidyon HaBen. Now, what we have today, I unfortunately only learned this too late, as there are certain people in Jerusalem who have literally pedigrees written pedigrees going back thousands of years proving that they're Kohanim. The recommendation is to do a pidyon haben with someone who can prove he's a Kohen, and not just
what
someone who calls himself.
You got,
right, let's see your papers.
How do you do it 1 month old? It's not something with a bat or something?
With a? There is such a thing as putting the kid on a tray, and they have these special trays for pidyon haben, first redemption. Put on a little tray, on a tray, and you hand the baby to the Kohen, and the Kohen says, I'll give it back to you if you can pay. By the way, I looked it up just a few hours ago, 105 shekels today is $122.
Oh, well, that's what that is, $122.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the custom is that synagogues have 5 silver coins for pidyon haben, and you buy them, you borrow them from the synagogue. And halachically, you buy it for, you know, for a dollar. Give it to the Kohen, and then the Kohen is usually nice enough to donate it back to the synagogue. Right? It's a symbolic thing. But really, the original correct way to do it is to take $122 out of your wallet, right, and give it to the Kohen.
And when you're older like that, then that's all there is to it? I don't remember really what we did.
Yeah.
I don't know that we offered him up on
a yeah, I actually photostated the ceremony on the sheet. Since we're talking about it, let's just look at it. I photostated from the Art Scroll Sidur. And you can see here, the bottom of page 219, it says the redemption of the firstborn. So the father says, this is my firstborn son, the first to show his mother's womb, and the Holy Blessed Be is commanded to redeem him, as it is said. Turn the page. And it brings the verses that we just read from the book of Exodus. Redeem him. Right? And that's the verses from Numbers and from Exodus. And then the Kohen says, which do you prefer, to give away your firstborn son as the first issue of the mother's womb, or to prefer to redeem him for 5 shekels? And the father usually says, I want to get rid of him. Kidding. So the father says, I want to pay, and he pays.
Yeah, that's a danger when you do it. You got a teenager already.
Right.
Just give it to him. Give it to you.
And we have 2 blessings. One blessing is Shehianu, the blessing we always say for auspicious occasions, and then a specific blessing for this mitzvah. Blessed art you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us regarding the redemption of a son. And then the Kohen blesses the boy, and you a glass of wine, a blessing, and then you make a sudat mitzvah, a meal. Mm-hmm. Bagels and lox, whatever it might be.
That's the only thing I remember, was we had a nice meal.
Oh, okay. So you know it was done. So that's the story of the pidyon haben. Any more comments before we go back to the Chumash? No. So we're going to go back to the Torah. And I'm going to get my bearings here. Right. Yeah. So I just want to point out, before we go on, that this ceremony of Pidyon HaBen, according to the verses that we read in Exodus, they said the commandment kicks in when the Israelites will enter the land of Israel, which means the 40 years they're going through the desert, there's not yet a commandment to redeem the firstborn, and the firstborn remain consecrated to God. Okay. Now let's remember, get our bearings. This whole thing is about trying to understand what it says in the verses in Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, that Moses was commanded there in the desert in the second year after leaving Egypt to make a switcheroo and to take away the holiness of the firstborn and put the Levites in their place. So, and now we've learned why the firstborn have this holiness, right? We've talked about that. Now we're going to talk about the Levites. Why did God say to replace the firstborn to the Levites? Why not with some other tribe? What's so special about the Levites? Getting to what you brought up earlier. So now we're going to look at the background of the Levites, and we're here at the top of the back of the piece of paper, C. C. The historical and religious background of the Levites. So the place we begin is Genesis chapter 34. Genesis chapter 34. Chapter 34 is the story of the rape of Dinah. If you remember that gruesome story, chapter 34, verse 25. And the background, of course, is that Dinah was raped by a certain princess of the men of Shechem, and she's basically taken hostage. And then the people of Shechem say, we want to marry her, and let's intermarry among ourselves, our tribe and your tribe. And the Israelites say, okay, but you have to circumcise yourself first. And the whole matter of circumcision seems to be a ploy to weaken the men so that they can be attacked and slaughtered by the 12 Israelite boys. Verse 25. On the third day, that's after the circumcision, when they were in pain, Shimon and Levi, two of Jacob's sons, brothers of Dinah, took each his sword, came upon the city, unmolested, and slew all the males. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword, took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went away. The other sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the town because their sisters had been defiled, etc. And the point is, it looks like Shimon and Levi were the instigators behind this murderous plot. Now, it's a whole question. Should we justify what they did? Should we not justify what they did? They have any choice. If they didn't do what they did, they might have lost their sister. Leave that aside. But what's clear is that Shimon and Levi have a certain strength of character, which others might call zealousness, that leads to violence and murder and slaughter. So now, let's read chapter 49, verse...
What does that have to do with being the firstborn, with our first subject?
Because we're getting now to why is it the Levites were chosen to take the place of the firstborn, not any other tribe, but specifically the Levites. So here's something about the background of Levi, who's the father of the tribe of Levites, obviously. Chapter 49, verse 5 of Genesis, going to the end of the book of Genesis. 49:5. And these are the final blessings of Jacob to his 12 sons. We read early the blessing of Jacob to Reuven, right, who was the firstborn. Now what about the blessing of Jacob to Levi? And it says here in chapter 49, verse 5 and 6 and 7, Shimon and Levi are a pair. Their weapons are tools of lawlessness. Let not my person be included in their counsel, says Jacob. Let not my being be counted in their assembly, says Jacob. For when angry they slay men, and when pleased they maim oxen. Cursed be their anger so fierce, and their wrath so relentless. I will divide them, and Jacob scatter them in Israel. He's obviously referring to what we just read. He's referring to the murder that they committed after the rape of Dinah. And their father calls them angry, violent men. And he curses them by saying they should be divided in Jacob and scattered in Israel. They're not going to get a tribal inheritance. They're going to be scattered among the other Israelites eventually. Okay? Now fast forward to the book of Exodus, the golden calf. Golden calf in Exodus chapter 32, verse 25. And it's all on the sheet. Exodus 32, 25. Moses on the mountain, Mount Sinai, getting the Torah. After 40 days and 40 nights, God's about to send him down, and the golden calf occurs. All hell breaks loose. The Jewish people go on into an orgy of idolatry. God is very angry. And Moses comes down the mountain, sees what's happening, and we read the following. Chapter 32, verse 25. Moses saw that the people were out of control, since Aaron had let them get out of control, so that they were a menace to anyone who might oppose them. Moses stood up in the gate of the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come here." And all the Levites rallied to him. He said to them, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, each of you put sword on thigh, go back and forth from gate to gate throughout the camp, and slay brother, neighbor, and kin, and slay all those who are worshiping the golden calf." The Levites did as Moses had bidden, and some 3,000 of the people fell that day. And Moses says, "Dedicate yourselves to the Lord this day, for each of you has been against son and brother, that he may bestow a blessing upon you today." So it turns out the same Levites, the same family that has that zealousness and that violent streak which allowed them to murder the perpetrators of the rape of Dinah, that same family has the courage and the fortitude to be zealous for God when it's necessary and to kill those all who are engaged in idolatry. Now, if the Levites were the only tribe that responded to Moses' call, who is on my side against those who are worshipping the golden calf, the impression we have to get is the Levites are the only tribe that didn't participate in the sin. And they were the ones that helped Moses regain order after that sin. So now...
So they redeemed themselves.
They redeemed themselves. Right? It's that same quality of character, of zealousness, of a streak of violence, of utter dedication, even when it means violence. That same quality that we see after the rape of Dinah and that we see here after the golden calf. So I mentioned to Lori an hour ago already that there's a positive and negative reason why it's the Levites who are chosen to take the place of the firstborn. They have this zealous strength of character, but it's not just that they're being rewarded, it's also a matter of harnessing something that could go wrong, harnessing it for the right. You hear what I'm saying? Right? And part of it, as we're about to see, is not just that they're supposed to serve God in carrying the sanctuary and guarding the sanctuary and dismantling and putting it back together. They're also going to be dedicated to the sanctuary throughout the life of the Jewish people. All the other tribes get a tribal inheritance. They don't. They live in scattered cities and they have a rotation when they go to where the tabernacle is to work there. Remember, because part of their curse is to be scattered. The theory apparently being that all those Levites together, you don't want them all together, right? There's too much energy there, right? There's too much zealousness. You scatter them, and you have just a small group of them come together at different times around the sanctuary to protect it and to guard it and to work in it. Yeah, so let's see now. Where are we now? So now we understand the background. We know all about the first one, we know all about the Levites, and we're back in the book of Numbers now to read about the ceremony in which one is interchanged for the other. Okay, so we're back in the book of Leviticus, and we're back in chapter 3, I believe it was. Let me see, is it chapter 3?
Leviticus?
I was wrong, sorry. Numbers. The book of Numbers, right. The book of Numbers. Back in Numbers. And we were in chapter 3. We read about half an hour ago, chapter 3, verses 11, 12, and 13. Let's find that now. So we read chapter 3 of the Numbers, verses 11, 12, and 13, about replacing the firstborn with the Levites. And then verse 14 says, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, record the Levites by ancestral house and by clan. Record every male among them at the age of 1 month up. And then the rest of the chapter goes on to say that Moses took a census of all the Levites from 1 month up, and he got their number. And their number is listed in verse 39. All the Levites who were recorded, whom at the Lord's command Moses and Aaron recorded by their clans, while the males from the age of 1 month up, came to 22,000.
Not very many.
Right, 22,000 out of 600,000. Right? And then, so they're one of the 12 tribes, and they're a small tribe. Some of the other tribes have 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, Reuven has 60,000. They're a small tribe. They're about 1/15 of the Israelite people. Don't check my math. It might be 1/20th. I'm not sure. Right. Verse 40. The Lord said to Moses, record every firstborn male of the Israelite people. Right? So they recorded the number of Levites, not the number of firstborn males, from the age of 1 month up, and make a list of their names. And it says in verse 43, how many were there? In verse 43, 22,273. Which means that there are 273 extra firstborn. Right, because we're going to interchange the firstborn and the Levites. And you have to have, for every firstborn, you want to desacralize, you need a Levite to take his place. And that's good for 22,000 Levites.
I don't understand this. What is this? Yeah, what's happening here? There.
Okay, so what we want to do is we have the firstborn, we said, but because the firstborn sinned at the golden calf, actually I forgot to mention that, perhaps I should have said that, right? The firstborn apparently sinned at the golden calf.
Did what? The golden
sinned.
Okay.
So,
like the firstborn of the Israelites.
Yeah, in other words, just like everyone else.
Yeah.
So the firstborn are losing their status. This theory theme, and again, thank you for stopping me because I didn't say this. This theory seems to be that the firstborn, because of their special status from time immemorial and from the plague of the firstborn in Egypt, they're going to be consecrated to God. They're going to be those who serve in the tabernacle. But that can't be because they lost their status by participation in the sin of the golden calf. Whereas the Levites didn't participate in the golden calf. So the Levites are going to be taken by God in place of the firstborn. The Levites will serve in the tabernacle. So now we have this ceremony right now in the book of Numbers, which we're counting the Levites and counting the firstborn. And the idea would be the exact same number of both, so that for every firstborn that we want to decommission, right, we have a Levite to put in his place. To say it differently, we're redeeming the firstborn, we're desacralizing them, not by paying 5 shekels, but by paying 1 Levite apiece.
Interchanging those.
Yeah, kind of reminds me of the Civil War when they taught us in 7th grade that you could get out of serving in the Union Army by bringing someone in your place. Right? So in order to do this ceremony of interchange, we have to count, and we come up with 22,000 Levites and 22,263 firstborn.
So that's a problem.
Laura, you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So for 22,000 firstborn, there's no problem. We'll redeem them, we'll desacralize them, we'll decommission them by putting a Levite in the place of each of them. But there are 273 firstborn that we don't have Levites to give in their place. What are we going to do? We're going to pay 5 shekels for each of those 273 extra firstborn. And that's exactly what the next verses say. Let's read 44. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites in place of all the firstborn among the Israelite people, and the cattle of the Levites in place of their cattle, and the Levites shall be mine, the Lord's. And as the redemption price of the 273 Israelite firstborn over and above the number of the Levites, take 5 shekels per head. Take this by the sanctuary, 20 gerah to the shekel, and give the money to Aaron and his sons as a redemption price for those who are in excess, etc." That's the blueprint for the ceremony that's about to be described in another few verses. So now, let's read the ceremony. The ceremony is in chapter 8, when they actually do it.
Is there a name for the ceremony?
No. Not that I know of. The redemption ceremony.
What does Pidyon HaBen mean?
Pidyon means redemption. Of the Ben, of the Son, redemption of the Son.
Yeah.
Pidyon HaBen. So this was a mass Pidyon HaBen, if you want. Right. You asked for a name. Chapter 8, verse 5. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, and I'll skip right to verse 10. "Bring the Levites forward before the Lord. Let the Israelites lay their hands upon the Levites." Because the Levites are going to become the representatives of the Israelites in serving the tabernacle. Theoretically, the firstborn should have been the representative, but the Levites are going to come in their place. "Bring the Levites forward before the Lord, that the Israelites lay their hands upon the Levites, and let Aaron designate the Levites before the Lord as an elevation offering from the Israelites, that they may perform the service of the Lord, as if we, the Israelites, are offering the Levites as our sacrifice to God, as what we're giving to God to do our work for us in the tabernacle." Let's read verse 14. Thus you shall set the Levites apart from the Israelites, and the Levites shall be mine. Thereafter the Levites shall be qualified for the service of the tent of meeting once you have cleansed them and designated them as an elevation offering. For they are formally assigned to me from among the Israelites. So I have taken them for myself in place of all the first issue of the womb of all the firstborn of the Israelites. For every firstborn among the Israelites, man as well as beast, is mine. I consecrated them to myself at the time that I smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt. Now I take the Levites instead of every firstborn of the Israelites. And from among the Israelites, I formally assign the Levites to Aaron his sons. In other words, the Levites are assigned to the Kohanim to be the assistants of the Kohanim, to perform the service for the Israelites in the tent of meeting, and etc., etc., etc. So now, time is very short. What I had planned to do at the bottom of this sheet is simply to point out from different verses in the Torah and in the whole Bible all of the different functions of the Levites. So I'll just say briefly that the Levites serve in the tabernacle. When we're talking about the desert, it's taking it apart and putting it back together. It's guarding it, it's carrying it. When they get to the land of Israel and the tabernacle is more or less stationed in one place, all the Levites have to do is to guard it. But they really are guarding it 24 hours a day. Obviously, you don't need all the Levites to guard it. They have shifts. We learned in other verses in the book of Numbers, the Levites have no tribal inheritance of land. Rather, they live in scattered cities. That's a fulfillment of the curse that they were cursed at the end of the book of Genesis. They'll be scattered. And there are 48 Levitical cities in the land of Israel designated by name. And six of those cities are also cities of refuge. Now, the concept of the city of refuge in one sentence is that those who commit manslaughter, unintentional murder, have to flee to a city of refuge. There are six of them in the land of Israel, and there's three more on the other side of the Jordan, altogether nine. All of these cities are also cities of the Levites. From here comes the idea that the Levites are not only guards in the tabernacle and the temple, but they're also teachers. Someone who commits manslaughter doesn't deserve to go to jail, but needs some rehabilitation, as it were. Why do they go to cities of the Levites? It looks like this is trying to tell us that the Levites have a function as religious and moral teachers. That idea is also confirmed in the book of Malachi, one of the minor prophets, as you have in the sheet. We're not going to look at it, in which it says, again, that the Levites are teachers. If we look in the book of Chronicles, which is at the very end of the sheet, and we're not going to look, I wrote there what we could see if we looked at it. The Levites are teachers. They're guards and gatekeepers in the temple. They're also logistics officers. They acquire the animals necessary and the wine and the oil that's necessary, the bread. And it also says in the book of Chronicles that they are the singers in the temple.
Singers?
Singers, yeah. While the religious ceremonies were taking place, there was beautiful song going on, harp playing and harps and singing.
A question. I wasn't paying any attention when you were talking about the cities of refuge. And were those, I know about the cities of refuge, but were those all of them Levitical cities?
All of the nine cities of refuge were Levitical cities.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just wanted to close with some of the stuff that we have on the last page. Most of it we talked about already. Just to point out what Levites do today. Today, Levites have two major honors. One is that they get the second aliyah in the in the synagogue. Right, the first aliyah when we read the Torah goes to the Kohen if there's one in the congregation, and the second aliyah goes to a Levite. And the other honor the Levites get, we no longer have a temple today, is that when the Kohanim go up to the head of the synagogue to bless the people, which in America is done among the Ashkenazim only three times a year, I believe. When is it done?
Rosh Hashanah,
Yom Kippur, and the three pilgrimage festivals. It's done five times a year. before the Kohanim go up to the head of the congregation, they have to wash their hands. And the Levites wash their hands for them. The Levites take the pitcher of water and pour it on the hands of the Kohanim. Now in Israel, we have the priestly blessing every single day. That means the Levites are washing the hands of the Kohanim every single day. But that's really, those two things are all that's left of the status of the Levite, except for the fact of what we mentioned earlier. Another honor of the Levite today is that his son doesn't have to do Pidyon Aben. His son, the firstborn, doesn't have to be redeemed. And it also goes, again, for the daughters of Levites. Their sons don't have to be redeemed, just like the sons of Kohanim and the sons of daughters of Kohanim don't have to be redeemed. Ready for the last point? The last point is something that I've been thinking about and thinking about literally for 10 years. And I'll give you my question and my answer here. If you were really, really paying attention, you might jump up and down on the table and say that we contradicted ourselves in a major point that we mentioned in the past hour and a half. What's the major point? Listen to this. You have 5 minutes to listen, right? No one's running out? So, we said that in the desert, as we read, the firstborn have their sacred status removed from them because they sinned at the golden calf, and they were replaced, the firstborn were replaced as agents of God by the Levites, right? We read that. We read the ceremony in the desert, okay? And we secondly read in the book of Exodus, in the book of Numbers, that there's a commandment that in every generation the firstborn should be redeemed by their parents, right? And we said we do that to this very day, right? Ostensibly, these two facts contradict each other. Why? Because if the firstborn... Yeah, if the firstborn have unique sacred status, they have to be redeemed. But take your pick. Don't be redeemed twice. One redemption is enough. So the firstborn were redeemed in a mass redemption sermon in the desert, right? And the Levites went in their place. So then why today do I have to redeem my firstborn son? He's been redeemed 3,000 years ago. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Why do we do that mitzvah today if the redemption ceremony already took place? So that really, really bothered me for many years. I think that's an easy answer. But the question is important. You ready for the answer?
Yeah.
The answer is, we have to remember the difference between the status, between the nature of the status of firstbornness and the nature of the status of Leviteness. A Levite becomes a Levite because he inherits it from his father. The firstborn don't inherit firstbornness. Firstbornness is created anew in every generation. And a Levite is a Levite because of his father being a Levite. Whose father was a Levite? Whose father was a Levite? Whereas a firstborn gets his status not because of anything inherits from his parents, but it's created when he's born. Right? A firstborn to his father and mother is firstborn, even if his father is the tenth born. Doesn't come from the father in that sense. Right? There, that's the answer to the question. Just think about it. Therefore, when the Levites in the desert were sanctified, that sanctification is passed on because that's the very nature of Leviteness. It's something that you get in inheritance. Whereas the firstborn that were redeemed, that were desacralized, right? That desacralization is only for them, not for their children. Because you don't pass on firstbornness to your children. The child becomes a firstborn ex nihilo, something from nothing. And therefore, even though that ceremony took place in order to give Levites their sanctity, it removed the sanctity only from the firstborn of that generation. Whereas every generation has to reenact that ceremony. Not in order to give holiness to Levites, they have it already, but in order to remove it from the firstborn. That'll cost you 5 shekels.
That's why then the Levite doesn't have to redeem the first, their first, because that's inherited.
He's already a Levite. Yeah. Right, he has that special status.
He has that special.
Right, it wouldn't help to redeem it because you can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what's the negative?
Oh, the negative that we discussed earlier, that the Levites are given a special status, not only because they deserve a prize, but also because we have to
rein them in.
Thank you. Right, because of their violence.
So they supposedly have a different character, temperament.
That's the theory. Obviously, thousands of years have passed since then.
Right.
That's the story. And now we can